Welcome to Radio Salam Shalom, podcast number 9. This is podcast number 9 here at Radio Salam Shalom, and a very warm welcome to you. We're going to continue our theme in podcast number 8, where we talked about dialogue and the whole situation in Gaza and the Middle East. That theme of keeping the vision of peace is what we're going to be talking about again here on podcast number 9, and we're going to be looking at people who are actually keeping that vision alive, the people that are still talking despite everything that's been going on. Joining me will be a number of guests, and I'm joined by my co-host again, Javed. An interesting podcast number 8, where we talked about how dialogue happens, how the mechanics of it, if you like. Now it's actually about how it's really going on, and it must be difficult for people to engage in that dialogue and feel that they can do it in a way that isn't emotional.
I think that's the key, really, isn't it? To sort of to have that dialogue without any emotion, because you know, and maybe part of the process of the dialogue is to release those kind of emotions, and maybe that's why it's so important to have dialogue.
Part of the big issue around dialogue is having an end game, knowing where you want to be, knowing where you want to go. And how important do you think it is to have a vision?
I think it's very important to have a vision, but again, as I said in the beginning of the last podcast, you need to have the basics. You need to have basic peace in order to have those kind of visions. Then you can think forward and see, this is where we want to be. This is what we want to do. But at the moment, as you know, the situation in Gaza is horrendous. So I think once things settle down, perhaps that process could start up again.
And one of the difficult things, I think, for anybody involved in dialogue is keeping that vision. We have a very strong vision here at Radio Salam Shalom. Our vision is a world where people understand all aspects of Muslim and Jewish culture and heritage, creating the foundations of a positive future. And that's the way we would like to see the world.
في الصحو أو في الحلم في عيون Muslims and Jews talking together. This is Radio Salam Shalom.
Indeed it is, and we've talked about vision and dialogue, and with vision statements often come mission statements, and a man with both a vision and a mission is a gentleman by the name of Ben Keane. Now, he says he's committed to making a contribution to peace in the Middle East, and between February and July of this year, he's going to be coaching six participants in a leadership training program in Tel Aviv. Now, he's 38 years old, and he's got experience as a government health and safety inspector. But in fact, he's going to be doing something very, very different from that. Ben, welcome to Radio Salam Shalom. Tell us a little bit about what you're planning to do.
Hello there. Hi. What I'm planning to do while I'm out in Tel Aviv is create a sound recording team. And I'd like Israelis and Palestinians to be in that team. And the idea is to interview and listen to and record the experiences and the points of view of people who've been affected by or are affected by the conflict in that area at the moment, and have Palestinians listening to and recording Israelis, and Israelis listening to and recording Palestinians, to use those recordings in the local media to make a contribution to peace and healing in the area.
Now, clearly, this is something that we here at Radio Salam Shalom are very used to. We take for granted the ability that we can sit down and talk to people and interview them as we're doing now. But what do you feel is the power of something like this, the power of interviewing as a method of dialogue?
It has a fantastic opportunity for just completing relationships. So I've completed sound recordings myself. I've done two sound recording projects, and both have involved, you know, and just, I find just the process of actually, when you're recording somebody, you listen, and there is no space for you to speak and give your point of view. It's just purely listening to the other person. And then in addition to that, the time spent editing, I find, when you actually listen to them again, maybe three, four, five times, it really sinks in then what people are saying. And maybe you hear things that you didn't hear initially in the conversation, and I think it's a fantastic opportunity just to really hear and understand other people's points of view.
Hi Ben, Javed here. I just wanted to ask, what made you want to do this, and why go to Tel Aviv, and why go to Israel to do this? I mean, there's probably other projects you could do around the world.
Yeah, I went to Israel last summer, and as part of participation in the program which I'm going to be coaching, and just my time spent in Israel I found was absolutely fantastic, and I come from a Christian background, and it was amazing to visit the sites in Jerusalem, the history, the religious history there. I was just really, really moved by that, and it just seemed, I've always, since I was a small boy, wanted to make a contribution to the world, to peace in the world, and through my participation in that program, that now has become a reality for me. And I just thought, you know, what better place to start than here, the home of some of the world's oldest religions, and in fact this area is in conflict. And I just thought, if there's something I can do, however small, to contribute to that, that's got to be worth doing.
How would you say you've achieved what you want to achieve?
My intention in the 5 months I'm going to be out there is to create a team. So one measure of success will be that there is an ongoing team carrying out this work, and I'd like to have created at least 25 sound recordings by the end of that 5 months. I would be interested to see, you know, what feedback we get from people that we're interviewing and involved in this, and just to have some kind of a measure on it, a feel for, you know, whether it's making a difference or not.
Ben, one of the big challenges now, because obviously you had planned this some time ago, is that the situation out in the region is considerably different from probably the time that you first thought about doing this. How much more difficult do you think it's going to be to get Palestinians and Israelis sitting across a table interviewing them? Do you think that you're going to be able to achieve this?
I get that it is going to, that the situation has changed out there now, and you know, points of view are particularly polarized right now. But I just believe that it's possible. In a way, it's almost more important to do this work now, given what's going on out there. And you know, I don't. You know, obviously, it's going to. You know, we have to assess the situation and where we can get to in the country, and be very careful. And perhaps we can interview people, you know, using telephone, that kind of thing. But I get that, you know, there's going to be challenges. But I just believe that it's got to be possible, and it's worth the effort.
How are you going to mediate these interviews? Because there are bound to be situations where it's going to be difficult, where there's going to be conflict in the conversation. How will you mediate that?
Yeah, it's an interesting area. I mean, I'm very much coming from the point of view of the idea is to listen, and the idea is not to get involved in a heated debate about issues. I get that may well happen, and I will use my skills from my counselling training and the leadership program which I've been involved in to ensure that the interviews are set up in a way, you know, to be able to deal with that kind of eventuality.
I mean, Ben, I think I've been involved in sort of dialogue conversation here in Radio Slam Shalom. What I found is that people that do come to these kind of workshops or these kind of projects are the ones that normally are talking already or who have got an open mind. So I think it's the other people. And how do you reach the people that do not want to talk? I think that's going to be your real challenge once you're over there.
Yeah, I get that, and I really get that. I'm, you know, I don't have a huge experience in this area, so it is a huge challenge that I'm taking on. I believe that is good in some respects. I'm coming with an open mind, and I certainly don't have an opinion on how things should go. I just believe I believe that the fighting should stop and that talking should start. And it's just a blank canvas as far as I'm concerned. And anything I can do to get people talking and listening to each other and understanding each other, it is a good thing, I believe. And I realise that there's going to be huge challenges, but also huge possibilities, I believe.
Well, Ben, we wish you every success with those challenges and the possibilities. We really hope that you succeed in your task, and we hope, more importantly, that you'll be playing some of the recordings that you make here on Radio Salam Shalom. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much indeed.
This is Radio Salam Shalom.
Aboriginal Australians should be able to keep their culture together by using or exercising all these elements of today's reality. And that reality is development. And that development, I would think, is the way that should be right, not something that is put upon us or forced down our throats. You and I know that music is universal language, and it doesn't have any prejudice. It has one way of thinking, without prejudice, without prejudice, without prejudice, without prejudice, without prejudice.
This is Radio Salam Shalom. That was Hadag Nachash, Melodica, and before that, Nitin Sawhney developed. And joining me now is Daniel Lascar, who is one of our regular volunteers, but has actually been another person who's been out there doing the dialogue thing, if you like. He's been experiencing a lot of what's been going on in Bristol, also in London, with a slightly different form of dialogue, which is... it's actually demonstration. It's people going out in large groups, in public groups, and voicing their opinions. Daniel, do you see this as part of the dialogue process?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, we can just talk alone in a room together, or, you know, people can be united on the streets and make a bigger voice. So I think it has much more of a bigger impact.
What sort of impact do you think the demonstrations are having? Certainly, let's start with Bristol. What have you seen in Bristol?
Number one, I mean, I can speak from a personal level. Myself, I thought I knew somewhat about Palestine-Israel conflict and negotiation. And I've learned so much over these past 2 weeks historically about the place and how many people are out there on the streets that are, you know, very upset about what's going on, and they feel that they have to do something about it. So their idea is to actually go to these Stop the War demonstrations or peace vigils that are happening around and actually show solidarity to the people of Palestine. And a lot of information is down there. A lot of different groups may be down there, and they're passing on information about what's going on in Bristol, for example. I can say, you know, they've named, like... somebody come up with a fact the other day that 60% of the industry in Bristol is from arms, from, weapons that are sold to different regimes around the world. And, you know, this is something that I didn't even know about, and many other people in the room didn't know about. And we have companies like Raytheon that, you know, are making the missiles and bombs that are being blown up in Gaza and in elsewhere. And there's demonstrations about that to make people aware of it. Are you happy about this going on in Bristol? You know, this is what the industry is in this city.
One of the questions one of the accusations that's often levelled at these kind of discussions, these kind of debates, and these demonstrations is that it makes people aware there's an opportunity for a lot of people to talk, but it's never very informed. It's very one-sided, or the people that are organising them are people who have a very particular agenda and not one that's balanced or informed. Do you think that that's a fair accusation?
Well, I see in the mainstream, the BBC and etc., CBN, what have you, they'll have one side of the story. So these people that I've been seeing in these demos and vigils, they have another side of the story. So it's good to see both sides. It's not like one isn't being seen here. I mean, unless you actually go out there and find information from other sources, from the mainstream, you get a very biased opinion. So I do watch these mainstream news channels, and also I try to, you know, go out there on the street and meet activists and other people to get the other side.
Now, there have been demonstrations in Bristol and also around the southwest of England in the region. A lot of demonstrations also in London, capital of the UK, political capital of the UK, although if you're Scottish or Welsh, you might disagree with that. But there have been a lot of demonstrations of all sizes. You experienced a couple of those. Mm-hmm. How did that differ from what went on in Bristol?
Obviously, the multitude of people. First and foremostly, in Bristol, there's started off with peace vigils that were happening every day from 5 to 6 p.m. opposite the Hippodrome in the centre. And this was actually started a long time ago when Afghanistan was the invasion of Afghanistan about 7 or 8 years ago. And so this small group in Bristol started to make a peace vigil there, lighting candles and calling for peace. And then whenever something flares up, like currently now with the war in Gaza, then a lot more people started coming, and now they're up to about, like, it depends, like some days some less, but up to about 100 people were coming there. And then they've started another one in Easton. I think it just started last week, and it's every Thursday again from 5 to 6, and that's on the Stapleton Road. These are, you know, obviously much smaller in comparison to London. In London, there was 100,000 people plus. People had travelled from all over the UK in coachloads to show, you know, their response to all the things going on, trying to stop the war.
Were you surprised at who was on these demonstrations? I mean, was it predominantly Muslim people involved, or was it a mixture? Who was involved?
I knew, because I've been to Stop the War protests before regarding, you know, the Iraqi invasion, and it was just the same there. There's just all walks of life there. You can imagine every, you know, race, every religion, every colour of skin, every class background, every age. It just represented, you know, all the different diversities that we find in the UK. And I was very happy to see as well, there were many Jewish people there holding up banners saying, you know, Jews against this war. And I went up to them and I talked to them, and, you know, they're not very happy at all. And they're, you know, all united, standing that, you know, something should be done. So there was this march that was organized, the protest march on Saturday last week, which consisted of Stop the War Coalition and some other groups. And it started off in Hyde Park, and they had many different speakers there, Annie Lennox, Brian Eno, amongst others, who were speaking against all these atrocities happening. And then people rallied up, and they marched in a peaceful demonstration to the Israeli embassy. What the authorities had done to protect the Israeli embassy is sectioned it all off, so people couldn't go actually near it. What I saw, because I was at the front of the demonstration, is that the police were very... there was a very big force of police, all in riot gear, shields and helmets and what have you. And I saw some not so nice things. There was police all standing out with dogs barking in front of people, and it provoked some of the crowd, and some of the, you know... younger, reckless ones were throwing a few projectiles, like eggs really, nothing like big. And the police then were firing smoke bombs into the crowd, pushing women, all sorts there.
But all of this is, is, I suppose, the question that this comes, if we come back to the question of dialogue, the issues are, do these demonstrations end up with a controlled anger? Do they actually end up with dialogue, or do they simply end up with people becoming just more angry and frustrated about the whole situation? Do they actually have a purpose?
I mean, what I saw, I mean, even though the police were provoking people, and there were some incidences of some clashes, but for the multitude of people that were there, I don't think it was too big. But what it does, it spreads consciousness. This is what happens. People see this happening, other people that might not know what's going on in the world and be ignorant to it, and, you know, it has an effect on the nation. You know, there'll be some politicians that will hopefully wake up to this and start lobbying for Britain to do something about this. I was also in the council building in Bristol just a couple of days ago, where the only councillor that's speaking out against these atrocities in Gaza, Abdul Malik, he had a say in the weekly council meeting, and we went down there, a few of us went down there, and, you know, there was a lot of people that just didn't want to know down there. The councillors, they just was closed ears. So we went down there to ruffle a few feathers, and it was good, because when they had a vote on should Councillor Malik speak before any other agenda, at first the person who was chairing it just blatantly said, you know, no, we're not going to have that. Then we forced them for a vote, and then in the end, you know, it ended up, after Abdul Malik had said his piece, there was a standing ovation, not just from us but from other councillors.
So what you're saying really is that linking the dialogue to politics is what's going to work. Daniel, we're going to leave it there, but we will come to this theme here on Radio Salam Shalom, because our next guests are people that are taking that dialogue directly to the politicians.
This is a recently re-recorded one called Peace Train. I've been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Well, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world as one, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come. Someday it's going to come. Come take me home again. Come on with this train. Someday it's going to come. Come on with this train. Come take me home again. Peace train sounding louder. Light on the peace train. Come on with this train. Isekaya. Is out on the edge of darkness, there rides the peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country, come take me home again. I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world as one, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come. Someday it's going to come. Come take me home again. Come on with this train. Someday it's going to come. Come on with this train. Take me home again. Someday it's going to come. Someday it's going to come. Someday, someday, someday it's going to come. Now I've been crying lately, thinking about the world as it is. Why must we go on hating? Why can't we live in bliss? Isekaya, 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 isekaya. Peace train sounding louder, light on the peace train. Someday it's going to come. Come take me home again. Come on, be straight. Someday it's going to come. Come on, be straight. Take me home again. Come take me home again. Come take me home again. Come take me home. Come take me home. Take me home again. Someday it's going to come. Come take me home again. Come take me home. Come take me home. Come on, be straight.
Mashallah. Thank you. And a beautiful, beautiful night. And salamu alaikum. Peace be with all of you. Assalamu alaikum.
Here on Radio Salam Shalom, we've been talking to a number of people about dialogue, and Daniel was talking just now about the political side of dialogue and becoming engaged in that. In podcast 8, we heard from Diana Klein, who was from International Alert, who was also making the point that you can't have dialogue with people who don't have the ability or the power to be engaged also in the political process, and equally for the politicians to be engaged in the process with the people. Dialogue won't work. Well, one organisation that's trying to achieve that here in the UK is an organisation called Ministry for Peace. Now, they have stated that their aim is working for the creation of a Ministry for Peace within government and an independent civil society body working alongside it. So this is very much the balance of the civil and the political. We spoke to one of their directors, Alham Akram, and she talked to us about what they have been doing with the UK government.
Actually, most of my work is because I care about here, because I am human, because I want to, I mean, I consider each and everyone in here, we are a privileged people, privileged human being living in a democracy that equalizes between all of us, regardless of color, religion, anything. And in this country where my conscience sort of opened up much more and realized that we are all human, we share the same values, we share the same concerns about the future of our children and of our lives.
That was Ahlam Akram from the Ministry of Peace with their vision for how peace can work with politicians. We've been talking about dialogue and people who are actually keeping the vision alive, trying to keep dialogue alive despite all things political at the moment. And in fact, Daniel has been talking about the issue of demonstrations and how that creates a particular type of dialogue and the frustration of getting to politicians. We've heard from the Ministry for Peace and how they've been trying to work with politicians as groups. But sometimes the hardest dialogue can be two people sitting in a room together, particularly where they are not directly involved in conflict but are from cultures which are. Joining me, if you're a regular Radio Salam Shalom listener, are two of our regular presenters, Javed and Tal, and I know that you'll have heard in the past a lot of dialogue between these two guys, but right now it's probably the hardest time for you to be sitting in a room and having dialogue.
It was to start off with, I think, but I think once we got talking, things seemed to sort of get better. Now, Tal, do you remember I went to a conference on Sunday, and it was regarding Gaza, and they were basically collecting money for the people of Gaza and trying to help them in the situation there. And I remember seeing some documentaries on Gaza and some of the pictures, and the speaker was talking about some of the things that were happening there. And that was the first time that really hit me how bad things were there. And I felt really upset. I felt really low and stuff. I don't think I felt angry, but I just felt really upset that, you know, this was happening and no one seems to be doing anything about it. And there wasn't anyone that I could talk to and find out, well, why is this happening? Who can I go and say, why are you doing this? Why is this happening? And I rang you on Sunday evening out of the blue. I wasn't quite sure how you was going to take it. But I think in the end, it was, you know, we had quite a nice conversation. And
I think, I mean, we had quite a few of those phone calls, I think, in the last 2 weeks. Mm. I'm phoning you, or you phoning me, and, you know, what's going on, you know? And I've learned a lot from this week. Mm. I really did. And that specific phone call when you called me, and I remember sitting next to the phone and just not knowing what to say because... Mm. I mean, well, just to make it clear, I mean, I'm really, really against what's happening right now. Mm. It's really, really, and it's very hard for me to see all that stuff. Mm. And obviously, I am Israeli. I grew up in that country. And to see what's the sort of thing that government does. Yeah. And I still feel Israeli. So, you know, and I get that, you know, it's just really, what do you do? And before that phone call, I remember... the first, I think you called me and I called you when it just started, before things were very clear. And I remember just before talking to you, I spoke to my dad and I was quite angry actually, and saying, what's going on? You know, why is that happening? How is that any good? And very, being quite on the attack in that way. And then when you phoned me or when we spoke, I found myself automatically becoming defensive about Israel. And I remember talking to you about that before that, and you, one of the things I remember you said that you liked me, that is, I'm not that defensive, but I found myself automatically doing that. And seconds or minutes after, I was completely against what's happening, and that was quite interesting. The first phone call, and after that, I think we had a few more phone calls, and we got together as well. And I think it was a bit easier.
After I had gone to that conference and come back, I was feeling really upset and. I wanted to phone you and speak to you, but I didn't want you to be a defensive or try and justify what was going on. And I was quite conscious of that. And I wasn't quite sure how I was going to react when I phoned you and spoken to you, because I know at the end of the day you're Israeli and you're going to have some kind of loyalty towards your country. And I understood that. But I think I found it quite easy because I felt that you listened to me. You understood where I was coming from. And I think you acknowledge the hurt I was feeling, And that, I think that meant quite a lot to me, just that you necessarily couldn't do anything about the situation, but the fact that you acknowledged it in some way, that it made me feel better.
Yeah. I think one thing I've learned is try to keep calm. Mm. Because I went to quite a few extremes. I think in the beginning, in the beginning it wasn't too bad, but then when it got really bad, it became a bit, first of all, very defensive about Israel. And then I moved to the other side. I became really extreme, and I really felt disgusted with what's happening. And I was even thinking about writing some stuff, and actually did. But then I decided to not publish it, and I kept it with me. So and now I feel a bit better that I didn't, because I don't know. It's when these things happen, your emotions jump around, and I think it is good to just keep it calm for a bit and mainly just talk. And I'm really glad that we had these conversations on the phone, quite a few of them these last few weeks. And I'm also glad that we are here. Because I got a call from Javed yesterday saying that, he might come in here, but he wasn't sure. He wasn't sure that he wants to, and I felt, I don't know if he wants to. But then I got a phone call now saying, an hour ago, saying I'm in the studio. Do you want to come? And that was a really good relief to me. He is here, you know.
Counselors often say that talking can be cathartic. It's a way of releasing emotion. It's a way of just helping you to feel better and get through some of those difficulties. Have you both found that there has been a sort of catharsis, that you've been able to walk away and think, actually, I do feel better for this?
I don't know if it was a catharsis as a huge peak, but it definitely was a reassurance. It was a reassurance that, Javed is still Javed, and I'm still me. That's what I felt. What did you feel?
As I said before, it was, the situation is still bad, the situation is still going on, but it definitely did help me. It was like unloading a burden, and I felt I loaded that burden on you, and you were able to come back and explain a few things to me that I didn't know before, and just really be able to hear the words and acknowledge what I was saying. And you sort of you accepted how I was feeling. You accepted it was a bad situation. I think that's all I needed to hear from you. I didn't need to hear anything else. I didn't want to hear you being really defensive or trying to justify any violence.
Yeah.
And I knew you wouldn't. But
Well, I must say it was very easy too. I found myself, even though I didn't think I would be like that, but I found that I could have very easily go that way. And this whole situation also proved to me that it's so important to know the people around you. Let's say focus in England, we need to know who our neighbors, who we are here, because it's so easy going from a situation where we are very civil to each other but not necessarily know each other. When something like that happened, could be hundreds of thousands of miles away, but that can have an impact, and then we can easily turn on each other if we don't really know each other.
You have established this relationship between the two of you, and you understand each other. What happens when you go back to your respective communities, where you go back into the attitudes of family, of friends, of people in Israel, of Javed, your family in other parts of the world, who start to discuss from a position of where they've always been? How do you get through that, and how do you reconcile the conversations that you've had?
I think everyone's on their own journey, and everyone needs to make their own mind up and try and find out things for themselves. I've tried to do it by joining Radio Salam Shalom, and I think Radio Salam Shalom has helped me to deal with this, helped me during this period of time. I think if I hadn't known Tal, maybe my views on Israel and on Jewish people generally would have been very different. But I know now that there's a lot of dialogue going on, that most people do want peace, and that's helped me sort of to try and sort of deal with the current situation.
I totally agree with this individual journey, because we were just a couple of days ago in another meeting with Mozambique and another guy, Chris, an American.
And Mozambique is the Guantanamo Bay detainee.
And an American guy, a prison guard, who was in Guantanamo, and they were talking. And one of the things that that guy, Chris, the American prison guard, said is the whole reason why he's doing these talks is that by doing these talks, he got a ticket to go to come to England and basically hang around Mozambique and other ex-detainees. And he's just really mainly doing it for himself. It is a bit egoistic, but I think I agree with you. And eventually it is the change that comes in myself. And I think every person have to do this journey. Hopefully, you know, we can influence a little bit our small surrounding. And we have to hope that what we're doing is affecting everyone else.
Yeah.
Do you find yourselves getting involved in a more balanced argument? Do you find yourself being defensive for the other side, if you like?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I have done so, and I have been defensive on many occasions to certain number of my friends about Jews in general and also about Israel. Mm. I think that's maybe one of the reasons why I was so sad about the current situation, because, you know, I had that dream. I wanted to like Israel, and I really want to understand the whole concept behind Israel. And I felt that what currently happened just sort of, support those kind of ideas I had. And
I think many people share that thought.
If you have a vision for the two of you, but also for your communities, what would it be?
I mean, my vision, it sounds funny, but this is something I discussed with one of my other Israeli friends, Naomi, who was a Radio Slam Shalom presenter as well. And we all laughed together. And we said, one day it would be nice to sit in Nazareth, I think, and all of us have tea together in peace. And there's no conflict going on.
Palestinian and Jews can live together. It's obvious. I'm 100% sure about it. There's no need to have two countries at the end of the day. I know that the way is very long to that, but if you ask me for a vision, there for sure can be just one country.
When I say salam, everyone say shalom. Salam! Salam!
Jews and Muslims talking together. This is Radio Salam Shalom.
Because of so much that's in the news, we know, is so diametrically opposed to what Islam is. So we'd like to remind ourselves that the word Islam actually comes from the word salam, which means peace. So we're going to hear some ideas of how to create peace from our students, Sarah and Ahmed.
Here are some ideas of how to make peace. To make peace, people should stop wars and fighting. They should help the needy and the poor. You can make peace by sharing everything and not doing anything that people dislike. People should care and be kind to young children, and they should not get into a temper when they are angry. Children should also respect the elders. People should stop fighting and stop making weapons for war.
Ideas of how to make peace in the world. Be kind to everyone you know or you don't know. Be friends with each other. Treat people from other religions with respect. Try and be fair and share with others. Don't force nations to adapt your point of view. Treat people with happiness. Don't blame kids or adults for things they haven't even done. Don't spread bad rumors. Spread peace and people will be good to you.
Podcast 9, and we've heard a lot about what's been going on here in the UK from our various guests so far. But a lot of work has also been going on in Europe, and one organisation has been very involved in dialogue initially with the Jewish communities, but now very much with the Muslim communities as well, the Centre Européen Juif d'Information, CEJI, based in Brussels, and we actually have spoken to their director, Robin Sclafani, who was telling us a little more about the atmosphere of dialogue in and around the different countries in Europe.
We have a meeting scheduled here in Brussels of the executive committee of the Jewish-Muslim platform for cooperation, and this is the main point on the agenda. Where does the dialogue stand now in the wake of Gaza? what is going on locally in your dialogue efforts? Are you standing up together? Maybe we might not be able to come up with a common political statement, but what can we take a statement about in terms of our relationship with each other and around what negative repercussions there are on the peoples here where we're living? Well, I think there's a lot of healing that's probably going to need to take place during this year. There's some old wounds that have been reopened during these last few weeks, and I think people are kind of, you know, trying to protect their wounds right now. And we're going to have to come to a point where we're able to heal together. I give an example of something I heard today. The Belgian government has flown in about 30 Palestinian children for care in the hospitals, and the local Jewish community here is organizing to be able to help and reach out to these children and help provide things that they may need while they're here. And in that sense, they're looking towards the future, that these Palestinian children will remember that Jews cared about them too during this crisis. We're hoping over the next year to have a project that really focuses on the role of arts in dialogue. And I think the arts is a really great method for people to express emotions in healthy ways, and being able to do that will help heal the wounds as well. We share a common society. To be able to live together, not just coexist in parallel worlds, but really to live together, to know each other, that our children can play together, that we can disagree in ways that without communicating violently, we can be all the different parts of our identity and not feel demonized for one part of our identity, or guilty by association in that sense. I think that's part of the vision, that we can appreciate each other for the complex individuals, the complex cultures, and to share a common community together.
Robin Sclafani, director of SEJI in Brussels, and clearly still a lot of activity going on with dialogue in and around Europe and Muslim-Jewish dialogue. And that's something that here at Radio Salam Shalom we have been extremely involved in for the last couple of years.
Jews and Muslims talking together.
This is Radio Salam Shalom.
And in fact, two of the people that have been instrumental in those dialogues have been Shabana and Lisa. And both of them in their own ways have been involved with dialogue amongst the Muslim and Jewish communities here in Bristol, but also further afield. Lisa, there's still plenty going on, there's still hope, but what's your feelings about, what's your vision about for dialogue now?
Well, my vision is that we have to keep talking to each other, and that's actually very difficult because there's a basic fear of disagreement, and I've encountered that in the Jewish community where there's, I express a strong opinion and people cut me off, and it's very hard to maintain dialogue if people aren't willing to accept that actually we do have different points of view. But my vision is that we can keep talking and eventually get to a place where we create a vision, a positive vision for the future together. I have my opinions, what I'd like to see, but I want to be able to talk about it with other people because then we have a chance of creating it. And it seems to me that it's not enough just to say stop the occupation or stop the war, because that's a very limited vision. I want a vision of what kind of society we could live in, something that will inspire us to work towards it. And at the moment, the only vision that's really being talked about is a two-state solution, and that to me doesn't feel like something that would really inspire me to want to work towards it. I would like to see something which is best for all the people in the region, not something where some people are in some kind of reservations or, you know, Bantu lands, and other people are in a state which is based on fear. I would like to see something that works for everyone in the region, and we need to keep talking about what it is.
It's not just about the region, though. You've just talked about the fact that a lot of the communities locally, people are not engaging in dialogue. They don't want to. They're scared of it. Shabana, it must be hard if people don't want to engage. How do you actually get them to engage, or don't you? Do you just ignore people that don't want to know and talk to people that do?
It's really difficult, actually. And to be honest, my encounter of the dialogue that's happening within the Muslim community, although a lot of it's been very good, one of the things that I've kept coming up against is this idea that what's happening in Gaza and in Palestine is linked to nearly every other thing that's happening in the political global situation. So there's been links between Palestine and then Iraq and then Afghanistan. And I really don't like that, because I think that by seeing what's happening in the Middle East as one big giant monster, you're not giving it the amount of attention and respect really it deserves. You know, you can't just see it as one big monster. That's one thing that I've really encountered, and I really hope that the Muslim community is able to overcome that.
Do you get a lot of people saying, why are you doing what you're doing? Why are you engaged in dialogue at all? Dialogue will never work.
To be honest, no, I haven't. And I'm happy to say that. Most people do agree that dialogue is the best thing. Like you said, Lisa, it's having the confidence to exactly say what you really want to say without being afraid that you're going to be silenced or that you're going to make other people feel uncomfortable. I think there is at the moment a tendency to walk on eggshells because we are quite cautious. We don't want to offend the other person. It's such a volatile situation. We don't want to do anything to exasperate that. But similarly, we have to say what's on our mind, because how else are we going to, you know, fulfill our vision if we don't actually say what our vision is?
And I suppose there is a feeling amongst some people, and we've talked with organisations like Seiji, who themselves are not taking a position at the moment, that actually, what can you say? That whatever you say, someone's going to react. Everyone is emotionally so raw that it's very difficult to actually engage in dialogue at the moment, but it will come. Tal, you stayed in the studio with us, and clearly this is something that you feel quite strongly about.
I'm just really happy to hear what you said about what are you not happy with, this feeling that everything is connected together between Gaza and Iraq, because this really reminds me of something very Jewish. You know, for us, everything that happens, it doesn't really just happen now. It's always connected to something happened 60 years ago, 100 years ago, 2,000 years ago. At the end of the day, it is, you know, if you read about it, Amalek. Amalek was a nation in the Bible that always were fighting Israel. And we always have these enemies. And it's very similar. What do you do with that? You know, how do you fight that? It's just too difficult.
I know. And I think as soon as you start looking at these situations around the world independently, that is going to be the start of the process. Towards, you know, dialogue and hopefully peace.
And also, when we stop making assumptions, a lot of times when people criticize Israel, they're accused of being against the people of Israel, the Jewish people. Yeah. And even accusations made against Jews.
Well, stay with us because we will continue this, but we're going to hear from another group of people who we've heard a lot from, and of course big changes going on in their country, because this is out in the USA, and the Traubmans have been regular correspondents with us. So a special report has been made for us by Len Traubman as part of the Jewish-Palestinian Living Room Dialogue, and he's talking to one of his Palestinian friends about some of the issues that we've been discussing here on Dialogue.
Hello again, Radio Salam Shalom from the west coast of the United States in our 16-year-old Jewish-Palestinian living room dialogue. I'm Len Traubman, and I'm an American Jew.
And I'm Elias Barrow. I'm a Palestinian-American, born in Jerusalem in 1932, came to America in 1954, and when the war started, the family took refuge and we went to Bethlehem in 1947, Christmas time.
So that's our dialogue partner, Elias, that you have not heard yet. And during these times of war, this abject failure of communication and of the human spirit, with the devastating death of increasing hundreds of Gazans and some Israelis as well, people are asking how we in the dialogue are doing and what we're doing to keep the vision alive. And we did just have our 201st meeting, and as you might expect, I think I'd describe it as intense. with the human range of emotions, from weeping to rage to always maintaining, as we promised one another, a really good quality of listening and trying to heal together and stay creative. But in addition to expressing ourselves fully as humans, in this month's dialogue, we took time to hear from each person, from our own lips, who we are, who is this dialogue, and who are we not in these times and in this process of change. So, Elias, maybe you'd just say a bit about what you heard.
Yeah, what we are not the politicians who write treaties and sign agreements between states and countries. We are grassroots people, Palestinians and Jews at large. Even we have among us Israelis who believe in the coexistence, who believe in hearing the other side of the story. And in essence, dialogue is about listening, compassionately listening to the other side. It is more than you tell your own narrative, is to hear the other side's narrative. And listening to both sides, then to take it, make a judgment of what to come up with after hearing the other side of the story, instead of, no, this is mine or this is yours, is to relate to each other where we stand and what are our aspirations, and try to come to a resolution between us, that we come in as friends and we leave the meeting as friends, even though we differ in our opinion sometimes. And even like this time with the Gaza situation, there are a lot of feelings and emotions, a lot of tears were shed, tears over Palestinians' casualties from Jewish people and vice versa, tears from Palestinians' people over Jewish casualties as well.
So we are those who are living our life together, and we're really what's new and what life will look like beyond war, because we realize that no government and no people is going to go down a road where they can't see what life looks like around the corner. So we are those who are modeling what life's going to look like. If you want to see more about what we do in the community, there are several hundred examples of our outreach activities. Just Google Jewish-Palestinian Progress. Jewish-Palestinian Progress in your search engine. Our next gathering is going to be in a home in the dialogue next Tuesday to watch together the inauguration of Barack Obama, our 44th president of the U.S., and to remind ourselves also of who we are, remembering what he said in his campaign, and that is that change doesn't come from Washington, change comes to Washington. We take that very personally as a beacon call for us to keep increasing our unprecedented compassion and creativity that Elias described for a new world of real salam and shalom. So next we invite you at Radio Salam Shalom, you listeners, to hear in a moment an example of how United States radio and TV is seeking out the dialogue of Muslims, Christians, and Jews among us who are in authentic, ongoing relationships, and broadcasting about the dialogue is not simply human interest stories anymore, but the new kind of hard news that is creating the future. So for now, for me, Len Traubman, shalom from California, USA.
From me, Elias Barra, salam alaykum jami'an wa atamanna lakum al-wafaq wal-mahabba bin sha'bin, bin al-falastiniyya wal-yahud. Like they say in English, when there is a will, there is a way.
Jews and Muslims talking together.
This is Radio Salam Shalom.
And our thanks to Len and Elias for that piece from America. We'll be hearing more from them, as we do regularly in their living room dialogue. So thank you to them. We have one final guest, and really someone who perhaps wraps up the whole issue of dialogue. And this interview was in fact recorded before the conflict restarted again in Gaza, in a very major way a couple of weeks ago. This is an interview with Gershon Gan. He's the former ambassador to Israel for Zimbabwe. and he spoke to me about dialogue and about the issues that are faced by his own country in Israel, but based on the experiences that he had had elsewhere.
It's a large community compared to the other communities that I've had experience with. For instance, in Zimbabwe, with a community when I was ambassador there was only 1,000 strong, and because of the tragic developments there, that community has dwindled down to a few hundreds, and suffering, as indeed are the people of Zimbabwe suffering. So the situation here in this country is very different. A very well-developed infrastructure of community activity and educational activity, and the resources available to men to do many things. The connection with Israel is very, very strong. My experience has always been a positive one. Of course, there are those in the Jewish community who take, I'd say, have difference of opinion about Israel and its policies, but that is to be understood. But the personal connection has really been with the community down here in Bristol because of the ties with Hilary Kay, who was so involved in the Bristol and West Progressive community.
How much communication have you had with the Muslim communities in Britain?
Well, back in the 70s, when I was here, I think that the peace treaty with Egypt, if I remember correctly, did bring about a sort of a breakthrough in terms of Israeli contact, perhaps with Muslim communities here. As I understand it, the Jewish community here has always had an interest in furthering contacts and dialogue with the Muslim community. And the Muslim community in this country, the Jewish community by and large, although they're very involved and concerned about local questions on which they have a basis for discussion and dialogue, which I think is paramount, is made. They also have concerns about the Middle East, as they might do about what's happening in India, for instance, or Pakistan or elsewhere. So I think that dialogue here can only further the building of bridges, say, in the question of the Middle East, and facilitate perhaps dialogue in the Middle East as well. So to my mind, it's all to the good. It's much better to sit down and trying to understand what it's all about and not stay, you know, just behind the rhetoric, the stale rhetoric of the past, which doesn't serve any purpose, to my mind.
You talk to the community about the issues that Israelis face on a day-to-day basis, but would you also accept that similar challenges are faced by Palestinian Arabs in and around Israel's borders, and that it isn't a one-sided argument?
One has to look at the realities of today and accept, I as an Israeli, and I believe that most Israelis do accept that the Palestinian Arabs have suffered a great deal over the years. But it's not only the responsibility of Israel to try and redress these issues. We have to dialogue, we have to try and achieve some sort of conciliation, which would mean both sides making concessions. Concessions not just in physical terms of borders or whatever, but in terms of the narrative that you believe in. It's not a question of saying, okay, I believe that the other side is completely right and we have to give up all we've believed in up to now. But coming to some sort of consensus which says that in order to provide a better future for ourselves and for our children and grandchildren, we have to take our narratives and what we strongly believe in and see how we can tailor that to fit the realities of the situation today. And that is most important. So, yes, there's suffering on both sides, and we have to try. The main reason for dialogue and trying to achieve peace is to stop the suffering on both sides. And the question is that people who believe that there has to be a better future have to stand up and be counted. And we in Israel, you know, go to the polls in February and have to choose a new parliament and a new prime minister. And people will have to make some very serious choices about what kind of future they see for the state of Israel and what kind of policies we will be undertaking. And I would hope that on the other side, so to speak, there's also that type of soul-searching to see what was done wrong in the past and what can be done in the future not to give up on all that you'd hope and aspired for, but just to realize there's certain realities and compromises have to be made.
Politically, we are in some of the most turbulent times we've seen for many years. Does that make you feel you'd like to be back on the front line, working directly in the political front line, or are you actually glad not to be there at all?
Well, I don't know. You know, there comes a time where you feel there's a need to turn over to younger people, fresh ideas. You've made a contribution. I still am involved, and in one area which I think is making a contribution to building bridges between Palestinians, the Arabs, and Israel. I was very involved for many years in Israel's overseas humanitarian and technical assistance programs to the lesser developed countries. One of the major aspects of this work was cooperation between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. From 1994, when the authority was created, till the outbreak of the Second Intifada in September of 2000, hundreds and thousands of Palestinians participated in Israeli training courses and exercises. The main purpose was to transfer technology to provide Palestinians with technical and professional capabilities in order to develop their state institutions and develop the economy and society. So those programs still continue on a much more limited basis, but hopefully the political and security situation will improve, and this will enable the Israeli agency, the Center for International Development, to broaden these programs. But I've met a number of groups of Palestinian ladies who've come to train in Israel and others. It's a drop in the ocean, but as I was told by these young women who came from Jerusalem, this was really the first opportunity that they had to visit Israel and meet Israelis, and beyond the professional issues, just to get a sense of what the other side is all about. So if you ask me if I want to be in the front line, I think that this is the front line, because until the politicians resolve the major issues, we still have to strive to achieve some sort of dialogue and make a contribution on a grassroots level.
With the election of Barack Obama, his Muslim background, but also the first black American president, do you see a time of hope or a time of hopelessness?
I always feel that one has to hope, one has to believe that there is light at the end of the tunnel. Barack Obama has generated a great deal of feeling, emotion, a great deal of hope, not just in the United States, but beyond its borders, a different America, different policies. We have a very strong relationship with the United States. I believe that it should continue. There are many issues that bind us to the United States. American support over the years, and I believe that America's involvement, very active involvement in the Middle East peace process is crucial, is essential to nudge the sides. We have to negotiate. It's the Israelis and the Palestinians, it's the Israelis and the Arabs that have to negotiate and resolve the issues between us and try to achieve some sort of compromise and reconciliation. But sometimes you need outside support and a bit of nudging and pushing in the right direction. And to my mind, this is why America's involvement is crucial in that sense. To my mind, American policymakers are committed to trying to achieve some sort of reconciliation in the Middle East, because it does serve American interests. And today, a new administration is taking the reins of power in Washington. The people that Barack Obama has been selecting, including Hillary Clinton of Secretary of State, very knowledgeable about the Middle East. They have America's interests at heart, but they also would have to consider the local partners to the peace process, like Israel. So I hope that this will lead to this process moving forward and being able to achieve reconciliation and to achieve what has not been we've been able to achieve in 60 years of Israel's nationhood.
That's Gershon Gan, former ambassador, Israeli ambassador to Zimbabwe and other African countries. And as we go from Bush
to Obama. We do have to ask whether this is a true chance for peace and perhaps the vision of peace that so many people are hoping for around the world. Mera Asha there and give peace.
Muslims and Jews talking together.
This is Radio Salam Shalom.
Podcast 9 here on Radio Salam Shalom, and we've been hearing about visions for peace. And one of the teams that we've heard a lot from over the last couple of years here on Salam Shalom is the Kicking It Back team, led, of course, by Adnan. He and the team are here in the studio to talk about their visions for Gaza and for peace.
People have been talking to Hamas and making it quite clear what the way through is. Now, my view is, in the end, as I say, of course what is happening at the moment is absolutely appalling.
When we can give support for the security of Israel and for the viability of the Palestinian areas.
Salam shalom.
Salam shalom.
It's Phoenix and Natural Bliss.
In the building.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year.
Happy Chinese New Year in about a month's time.
Yeah.
Happy Muharram. There was a happy Islamic New Year recently. Yeah, I mean, I think we're not doing our usual jokey opening and stuff like that. As you all know, this week the podcast has been dedicated to to stories based around Gaza and just what's been happening recently in the news. Obviously, a ceasefire broke down. Hamas, one side, start rocketing Israel. Israel has responded in kind, in self-defense with their full force, basically. Nothing else you can say.
Pretty much.
And we here at Salam Shalom, or Radio Salam Shalom, we want to reiterate this message of peace and calm and, you know, intercultural dialogue and whatnot.
Exactly. New year, new beginnings. You find out the news, you know, everyone had a pretty pleasant Christmas day, I'd expect. I'm one of the UK people. And to hear the very next day, you know, Boxing Day morning, rockets firing across the border, you know, can't be at peace for at least one day of the year.
Exactly. I mean, yourself, you're not Muslim or Jewish. In preparation for what we're about to do now, you were just shocked and you've been taken aback by why there's so much fighting going on.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, I'm external coming to the situation. I'm neither, you know, obviously Jewish or Muslim, so I view it as a complete neutral. I'll probably end up, you know, criticising some, but I just find it completely you know, incredibly hard at fighting over essential land, and to this extent, should I say,
yeah,
you know, rockets going back and forth. Civilians, innocent civilians getting caught up in this as well, you know, children, women, people obviously not involved in the situation, they're getting caught up in this. I just can't justify it at all, to be honest.
I don't want to take sides. I mean, me personally, I do see Hamas has been wrong in rocketing during the ceasefire. Why, you know, could you just not relax for a bit? That's what I thought.
I would have thought they would have wanted to stop. They would have not to bring any more sort of pressure onto their own country and their own
just
citizens.
Not cause trouble.
But surely, probably it's an old school mentality, but is fighting just completely not the answer to any solution?
It isn't. It takes a really severe situation for that to have to happen.
Very true.
I mean, is it not disproportionate to be sending in tanks and helicopters and whatnot to fight guerrilla fighters? You're not fighting an army, you're fighting a bunch of people who run around with rockets.
Yeah, it does seem a bit imbalanced, shall we say, as well. You know, got the full force behind them, they got their own army, and use of American weaponry, whereas Gaza probably don't have half of that. You know, it seems a bit of an imbalance in terms of the conflict there. And to me, it seems that Israel would come out on top in any case, if it did escalate any further than it already has.
I mean, like I said, I'm not saying that it's okay for Hamas to have done what they did. You know, it does annoy me a lot as a Muslim. You know, there's a strong sense of sisterhood and brotherhood, and it does pain me to see this go on.
Exactly, but it's a similar concept when two grown men fight, isn't it? You come to a point where someone's got to be the bigger man
and just stop,
and just, you know, stop fighting, realise the bigger picture. Is it just not that, just on a more of a global basis?
I mean, here's a statement from the group One Voice Movement, which is based around, which has offices in Israel, within the Gaza Strip, just within Palestinian territory, European offices. Obviously, they've been caught up in the middle of it. This was actually sent to Kyle because he joined them. I'll just check that. Dear supporter, like everyone, the One Voice team has watched the escalation of violence in Gaza and the south of Israel unfold with a mix of great sadness and a frustration that we haven't been able to do more to find a lasting solution. We have had many inquiries as to our views on what's going on at the moment and the welfare of our team, so we wanted to write quickly to touch base with supporters. First of all, our staff in the region are all safe and unharmed. Mawafak Alami, who some of you may have met when he visited London, spoke with our office yesterday afternoon, and thankfully neither he or any of the Gaza staff have been physically harmed. They are suffering the privations in common with the wider population and are living in fear and under massive stress. Very sadly, family members of our staff and board members have been killed in the violence, and we're all thinking of them during this extremely difficult time. We have, of course, maintained constant communication with our West Bank and Israeli offices, and while everyone is terribly impacted by the violence, they are all currently safe and well. Everyone is remaining resolute that our work will go on once this terrible period is over. Indeed, that will be more important than ever for One Voice to be active and engaged, but are realistic that this temporary reality makes it very difficult for our teams to act. Indeed, in the midst of this dangerous atmosphere, all of the One Voice teams are still trying to spread the message that the majority of Israelis and Palestinians are desperate for a way out and eager to find a lasting two-state solution. One Voice Europe wants to send our thanks to our supporters and our solidarity to all those suffering at the moment. Unfortunately, the further violence escalates, the more it exposes our need to work harder in realizing our goals. The majority on both sides, we want to see a two-state solution realized, and we need to do all we can to ensure that their voices are heard, particularly at times such as these where moderation is in danger of being drowned out. We remain in touch and look forward to continuing to count on your support at this most critical of junctures. Our office is, of course, happy to answer any queries or address any concerns that you may have. The One Voice Europe team. I don't actually know much about them. I looked them up. I looked on the website. Basically, they've looked to empower those moderate people, you know, with a voice, give those who are poor in those regions jobs to, again, empower them.
Mm-hmm.
And just get them to cooperate on projects with each other. A bit like what we do in Salam Shalom.
Yeah.
That's what we were sort of focusing on. We didn't, you know, obviously at the start of the segment, you just heard Brown and Blair's viewpoints on what everything that's been going on. I mean, we've just been looking at online sort of, you know, how the online community has reacted to it, and what have you seen online?
Indeed.
Bless, you go first.
Yeah, just an article found in one of the newspapers. Just looking at two viewpoints, one person who predominantly grown up in Israel and the other grown up in Palestine. They both live in the UK now. And they both have contrasting sort of views towards how this came about. I mean, just to read off, firstly, the guy from Israel, his name is Ruvi Ziegler, stating, "The idea was to allow the Palestinians to live in an uninterrupted life in peace and in coexistence." And then he starts stating, "Then Hamas started firing rockets at Israel towns which are in the internationally recognized boundaries of Israel." So that was his, the guy from Palestine, his name Ahmed Massoud, states, "Your guess," referring back to Ruvi Ziegler, "is saying that Israel left Gaza completely 3 years ago," which he did state that, "but that's not true," he states. "They may have taken their troops out, they may have taken their settlements out, but it did not actually leave Gaza free because they were still controlling Gazan borders. They controlled all the movements in and out of Gaza." So it's two contrasting stories.
I thought, what is the biggest social network in the world right now? On the internet.
I would say Facebook.
Pretty much
Facebook.
All these groups sprung up, and some of them have had thousands join, some of them are reaching hundreds, some of them are still small. A couple of the ones that sort of stood out, one was called "I Support the Israel Defense Forces in Preventing Terror Attacks from Gaza." Essentially, I'm not sure if it's official or anything, but it does seem to be based around official statements from the IDF on how they see, well, how they're going to operate. I mean, one thing on here in the recent news, that anyone acting as a human shield or anyone being encouraged, this is what an IDF spokesperson says, will be considered as someone who's sponsoring terror and will be considered a terrorist themselves. So could that make a little five-year-old a target if they act like a human shield?
Ooh, there's boundaries there, isn't there, really? I mean, obviously, from that definition, yes, but him being a child, underage, a minor,
exactly.
You look to sort of protect the, you know, the younger ages there. So, and he probably can't think for himself. He's, you know, at that age, knowing right from wrong or whatever he's been taught.
You know, there's videos about, such as Michael Bloomberg on YouTube, speaking about Israel and supporting them. A petition to stop the UN from condemning Israel for defending herself. I say it's just a bit of a stretch. That's what the latest UN resolution is just saying. Everybody stop fighting. Simple as. Everybody. Not just Israel. Everybody stop fighting. It's just because it's not saying enough about Hamas that people are a bit offended by it. But on the flip side, if we look up a Gaza group, this one was quite interesting. It's called "End the Siege of Gaza Now." There's a lot of Arabic writing. I can't read it in English. The recent news simply says, "Israel to hell." That's it.
Simple enough. You can read it from those words there, can't you?
That's not constructive, the way I see it.
Not at all.
Because, you know, that. What's the point? "Israel to hell." Yeah, it's clever. Within all these groups, you got lots of posts. You got wall posts. You got everyone talking about the latest news and stuff like that. And it's just interesting to see some of the comments. Some of them have degenerated into stupid little arguments on this one. Let me see. Yeah, they're just throwing disses at each other. I mean, what the hell?
Nothing constructive at all.
There's other groups on there that are great, including the ones that support Israel and supporting the Palestinians. They're great. They're just, like, down the middle. You know, some of them are trying to collect signatures or just simply trying to discuss things. You know, what is the point of throwing it out of proportion? This is what the online community is always about, debating and talking, not throwing names at each other.
Yeah.
I think it's the end of the show.
Indeed.
I think that was a pretty succinct way to set some everything up for now.
Yeah, and we do hope and pray, you know,
hope
conflict resolves
itself.
Some sort of resolution to this.
And I'd say no matter what way you cut it at the moment, there is a humanitarian crisis. It doesn't matter what you think of the Palestinians or the Israelis. Please help.
People need help.
I'd say help donate as much as you can. Help try and get your politicians and MPs to say, you know, say something back and say, don't let it happen anymore. Stop the fighting now. And as you can hear, we're playing the song in the background. It's Nickelback with If Everyone Cared.
Sums up, really.
Salam shalom.
Shalom.
See you at the next podcast.
Yeah. Peace out.
Salam Shalom, Muslims and Jews talking
together. So as we come to the end of podcast 9, we've explored over the last two podcasts dialogue, how it works, the mechanics of it, whether it can work, and the people that are hoping to make it work. So probably a chance now for a final word from each of the people that have joined us in the studio. Lisa, what do you feel? What's your final vision, if you like?
Well, we know that violence doesn't work, so I think the only chance we have is dialogue, because ultimately we all want peace and harmony and cooperation.
Shabana?
I have to say I agree with a lot of what Lisa is saying. Inshallah, you know, dialogue is the way forward, and I genuinely believe with all my heart that that's what we have to do now.
Javed?
I think in times of conflict, in times of despair, in times of disagreement, dialogue can work. But I think if that then goes on to war and persecution, I think then there's no room for dialogue there.
And your friend Tal?
I'll just repeat something that I've heard a little while ago. That an Israeli guy said that, you know, the French and the Germans and the English and the Italian and the Spanish fought each other so much and killed so many in endless wars, and eventually they stopped it and they start talking, and now, you know, we live in a continent where there's no border. You can drive from here to Greece, you don't have to show a passport once. It's definitely going to happen, inshallah. It is definitely going to happen.
And as if you need reminding, the vision of Radio Salam Shalom, a world where people understand all aspects of Muslim and Jewish culture and heritage, creating the foundations of a positive future. This has been Podcast 9. Salam Shalom.
This is Radio Salam Shalom.